Hello and welcome to our insulin resistance solution practitioner training. As usual, I like to remind you, and when you're working with people, have this disclaimer somewhere, you know, whether it's on the intake form that they do with you or something that they sign to let them tell you that they realize that you're not giving them medical advice, unless of course you are a medical practitioner, in which case it's fine. But if you're a nutrition coach, a health coach, an IIN certified coach, whatever you are, if you're not licensed to do diagnosis and treatment, just make sure that they realize that this is not intended to replace their one-on-one relationship with their doctor. It's intended as education, and you're helping to educate them about their diet and how that affects, especially if they're on medication. So make sure that they're clear that they understand it. And just to review, I'm just going to keep going over this. The normal blood sugar management. In order for you or your client to have good blood sugar management, it involves multiple organs. It's not just the pancreas. It's the pancreas, it's the liver, and it's the adrenals. As we go through, we'll tie it all together. We're going to tie together the hormones and all the other organs and stuff that are involved. But right now, tonight, we're focusing on food. So liver, pancreas, and adrenals. When the blood sugar gets too high, your body secretes insulin, and that helps, it's supposed to actually lower the blood sugar. And when the blood sugar gets too low, your body secretes glucagon, another hormone secreted by the pancreas, and that helps to increase the level of sugar in the blood. Insulin stimulates receptors on the cells so that the sugar can be carried across. We'll look a little bit further at the nutrients that are required for that and why it goes wrong. Glucagon basically goes out and it first goes to the liver and stimulates the liver to secrete or release some of its stored sugar. And that's in the form of glycogen. It also can stimulate fat cells to release some of the sugars, and that's called lipolysis, or some people call it lipolysis, one or the other. It can also stimulate a process called gluconeogenesis, which mostly goes after protein stores and breaks down things like muscle, stored muscle. That's the one we don't want to happen. Glucagon, though, tends to favor glycogen and next fat. So first it'll look for the stored glucose in the liver and some of it in the muscles, break that down. When that goes away, if there's none of that available, like if somebody's on a fast, then it will turn differently. So glucagon's your friend, and that balance of insulin glucagon is what allows you, or should allow you in the ideal situation, to go many hours between meals. If you don't make it to the next meal, if you're functioning properly, you get hungry, sure, you feel like eating, but your blood sugar doesn't crash because glucagon comes to the rescue and finds stored stuff. And even on a fast, a prolonged fast, I did a 28-day fast, it was fine. Your hunger just goes away because your body starts to basically eat itself and digest itself. This is what's happening in a well-balanced body, and this is what the goal is. Most of the people that you're going to be working with that have been identified as having blood sugar irregularities or insulin resistance, or have that body type that you're going, you have insulin resistance, and they don't even know, they're not functioning this way. The insulin's going too high. The insulin's not causing the sugar to go into the cells. The glucagon may not be secreted properly, or the glucagon may not be getting involved to help you, or the glucagon is causing the breakdown of the storage form of sugar into sugar, and then because you have insulin resistance, it's not really getting into the cells, and then you might be producing more and more insulin, and then finally there's a crash. There's a lot of different ways that this mechanism can go awry, and as we go through the program, I'll just keep reiterating and reviewing and adding layers to it so that by the time we're finished, you're going to really understand this process. And you're going to understand what's going on when somebody says, you know, I just can't make it more than 2 hours without eating, or 3 hours. I just feel like I'm going to crash and burn. That there's a problem there. That's not just, oh, it's just hypoglycemia. Eat every 2 hours. That's not solving the problem. It's suppressing the symptom. And in my book, that's similar to taking an aspirin for a headache. It's like, okay, it makes the headache go away, but it doesn't fix the underlying problem. You can eat to suppress the symptoms of hypoglycemia, to get rid of the irritability and the crankiness and the weakness, but you're not really fixing the problem. And then all these different pieces that we'll be going through, each week we'll be adding on to it. Again, take it at your own pace. Wherever we're at with this, take it at your own pace. It's affected by stress, diet, and genetics. Okay? So, again, I'm just going to review this in a different way, because when you see things in different ways, you are going to be feeling a little bit more confident about your ability to grasp it. You eat. Your blood sugar goes up. Your pancreas senses the blood sugar is above the healthy range, and it secretes insulin, which immediately gets put into the system. There's no delay. It's just like immediate. Insulin goes in and escorts the sugar into the cells. The blood sugar comes down. When I say immediately, like I said earlier, it usually gradual rise in the blood sugar. It peaks maybe at, 45 minutes, a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour after you eat, and then it comes down. Because the insulin is supposed to be secreted right away by the pancreas and is supposed to have the ability to escort the glucose into the cells, the sugar should never rise above 110. And write that number down, because that's what you're going to be targeting for. And we're going to be going through and correcting these at different places. So the insulin gets escorted through the cells, the blood glucose decreases, a hormone called leptin gets secreted, and that gets secreted by fat cells to trigger fat burning, to say we have plenty of fat, we don't need to store fat anymore, you don't need to eat anymore because we're full. And so let's just burn us, burn the fat. So the leptin is secreted by the fat to say, hey, I'm available, burn me. Don't eat anymore. No need to release stored muscle, burn me. And then the pancreas stops secreting insulin because it gets that trigger, not only from the blood sugar going down, but from leptin being in the system. And leptin stimulates two places, the pancreas and the hypothalamus. So then the pancreas stops secreting insulin. You get an increase in energy because all that glucose gets converted to ATP, which is the energy currency of your body. And then you just go along, and after a while, once that's burned up, you get hungry again after several hours. And then you eat. So that's the normal cycle. And there's breakdown in a lot of different places here. And we've talked about that before. The pancreas can produce too much insulin. Or the pancreas can be broken, as in the case of type 1 diabetes, where it's not producing enough insulin. Or it's producing enough insulin, but your body's producing antibodies that kill off that insulin, that break it down, and you don't have enough. Or you've got type 2 diabetes that's gone to the point where your pancreas gets burned out and you no longer make enough. So you can either not make enough insulin, you can make just the right amount, and that's when this perfect normal response happens, or the person can make too much. The triggers for what makes the pancreas produce too much insulin is what we're going to talk about, and that's some of the foods, and that's what you're going to be right away getting in and helping people to turn around, okay? And then when you secrete too much insulin for too long, you become insulin resistant because the cells are like, they're hurting. They're like, this is too much sugar, too much insulin. They put their hands up and say enough, and then they become resistant. And that can develop into type 2 diabetes when the sugars rise too high as a result. And a lot of folks with type 2 diabetes that's not controlled properly with diet and exercise and stress management and all the things you're learning now, then they go on to wear out the pancreas, because after a while it's been secreting too much insulin for so long, it gets worn out, then it doesn't secrete enough. And then those type 2 diabetics become dependent on insulin because their body's not turning it around. You will have the power to turn that around, to prevent those people from becoming type 2 diabetics. Or if they've already been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you'll have the ability to help them to reverse it, so they don't go into the depletion stage where now they have to do insulin. And I've seen it happen quickly in a matter of weeks. Depends on the person, how long they've been had a problem, how well they're following your recommendations. And then there's some genetic factors that play in. And some people have to be more strict than others. But I've seen it reverse in as little as 3 weeks, where I had somebody go from having fasting blood sugars of 220 down to having a fasting blood sugar of 85 in a matter of a couple of weeks. So it really happens quickly. Just worked with somebody recently who'd been struggling with this for years, and her fasting blood sugar never gone below 100. She just was always 104, 110. And not enough to say she's type 2 diabetic, but just higher than she wanted it to be. And we made one change in her diet. One. She'd been testing her fasting blood sugars all along because she'd been taught to. She'd never been taught to test what we call postprandial blood sugar. What does the blood sugar do after you eat? And once I taught her how to do that, and I suspected something with her breakfast, I said, test your breakfast and tell me. And it went up, and I said, okay, I think it's the grapefruit, right? Low glycemic fruit, she thought was fine. She replaced the grapefruit in her breakfast with chia porridge. And voila, for the last month, her blood sugar is steady at 85 when she gets up in the morning. You can see these changes happen quickly. And then you're the hero. They're like, wow, why didn't my doctor tell me this sooner? So a lot of places where this can go wrong, and we're going to teach you how to intervene. It's not just about diet. You know, a lot of people think it's all about the food, everything's about the diet, and you just have to go on this diet. And no, it's more than the diet, it's more than the nutrition. Stress can raise the blood sugar dramatically. And we have a lot of people that I've taken through that have said, oh my God, I realized my blood sugar was fine, and then I got this really stressful phone call, and I was stewing, and I took my blood sugar, and it shot up. And then same thing with exercise. Exercise can bring it down. And I've had somebody, you know, getting into that situation where their blood sugar was high. She discovered that if she goes out and walks around the block a few times for about 10 minutes, brings her blood sugar into a manageable range. Sleep is huge. There's a lot of studies that show that even one night of bad sleep can cause insulin resistance. Temporary, of course, but, you know, see somebody who's on shift work, or somebody who just is stressed and stays up late or has insomnia. That sleep is going to cause their blood sugar to be problematic. And finally, timing. We're going to start to talk about timing today, because you can be doing everything right but not timing it right, and that can be throwing off the blood sugar. And you need to be just really aware and cognizant of these different areas and start to talk to people about those and ask them questions so you can figure it out. I recommend that you start working with it on your own. Even if your glucose levels are perfect, go ahead and just follow the strictest protocol yourself, just so you get the feeling for what it's like, because emotionally you're going to need to support people through this as well as giving them things to do. So take yourself through it. See what it feels like in your body. See what the adjustments are like. Going on a low glycemic diet for somebody who has blood sugar imbalances can be uncomfortable for the first couple weeks. Okay, sometimes it takes up to, one of my mentors said 17 days, 14 to 17 days before your body kicks in to using fats more as fuel. And then you start to feel like really outstanding. So it could take a couple of weeks before the brain fog and some of those things go away. A lot of people jump right in and tell people what not to do. Stop eating this, stop eating that. And it's hard because there's cravings. So what I like to do is increase the insulin sensitivity, and we do that through some nutrients. That helps people to reduce their cravings. And if you immediately get them started on these nutrients, by the time you tell them what to avoid, they're not having the sugar cravings anymore. They're not having such severe swings, and they can follow through. I used to do it the other way around, and it works way better doing it this way. So this is the way I teach it now. And I find so many people, this is over and over again, it's almost across the board where I get them on the stuff, I don't start talking about the diet, and they're all of a sudden saying, wow, it's so nice not to have those sugar cravings anymore. And those sugar cravings, by the way, tend to be the strongest after eating. And if they're really off in their eating, it can happen worse after dinner. Like you eat a big dinner, they're full, but they have the sugar cravings. And you might experience that too. The nutrients that we'll talk about, I'll review them, are really critical. Decrease the insulin need. That's going to be the focus. And also reducing inflammation. Some of the foods and things that we're going to talk about are going to help to decrease inflammation. When the cell receptors get inflamed, they are not going to be receptive to the insulin. And we need to reduce that inflammation. And we're going to be talking about fat burning and lean mass building more when we go into the sleep and the exercise and the stress, because it's getting the balance between a hormone called growth hormone and insulin. And it's overlooked a lot. And when you can optimize that, you're going to get dramatic results. And then finally, minimizing what I call the impact of candy bar eating effects of stress. And we talked about that last week, where when you get stressed, it's like you ate a candy bar, but you didn't get the fun, right? Your sugar goes up because it's released from storage, because glucose is released in order for you to run away from a tiger. So we'll go through that in detail. So we're mostly going to be working on, I'll review the increase the insulin sensitivity. We're going to talk about in depth on decreased insulin need, and I'll share with you the resources I'll be putting up for you, and then reducing inflammation. So the symptoms of insulin resistance, again, in review, you're going to see this a lot. Belly fat, even on a thin person, low energy, especially after meals, when you would expect somebody to have more energy, that low energy after meals says, boy, that sugar is not going where it's supposed to. Hungry, even after a full meal, again, the food didn't go where it's supposed to. That mid-afternoon energy slump, because it's crashing, the blood sugars are crashing. Difficulty focusing. And then cranky and irritable if they skip a meal. Those are the main symptoms. There's a whole lot more. And in part one, I gave you an access to an insulin resistance questionnaire that you are welcome to use. Mine is an online and you can get your own back, but you can use that, copy and paste it into a Word doc and create your own, add your own other questions, reword the questions, you know, if you don't like the way I worded them, but you want to word them differently, ask questions or just take it and incorporate it into your own questionnaire. If you have somebody fill out an intake and a diet intake and their basic stats, you can just add these questions to it. So however you want to use it, that works best in your own practice. So let's review and introduce some new nutritional causes of insulin resistance, right? We already talked about the obvious, which is eating too much sugar and the receptors get burned out, but there's more to it than just that. An omega-3 fat called DHA is super important. And when it gets deficient in the cell membranes can't accept the signal of insulin. And that creates insulin resistance. When you are working with somebody and their omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratio is off, if it's too high, the omega-6 to omega-3 fats are too high, then they're going to have damage to the membranes and those membranes aren't going to be as receptive. You know who has omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid ratios too high? Almost everybody in this U.S. Western world, and some people in other countries as well. It's very common because of the foods that people eat. They're eating too many polyunsaturated fats. They're eating too many processed fats, too much omega-6, not enough omega-3. Omega-3 comes from, you know, chia, hemp, flaxseed, walnuts, and fish, and algae, and purslane. Okay, those are the main sources. There's not a whole lot. A lot of people go on a healthier diet and throw off their omega-3 and 6 ratios and are wondering why they're having issues because they're suddenly drinking almond milk by the quart instead of dairy milk. Well, yeah, that could be great if they're allergic to dairy and dairy causes sensitivities. Dairy has its whole host of problems. However, just switching to almond milk creates a plethora of omega-6 fatty acids. Not a great idea. So what I will have on your chart is a spreadsheet that you can use and you can plug in numbers and you'll see the ratios for various fatty foods, both vegan foods and fish and meat, how much omega-3 they have, how much omega-6 they have, and what's the ratio. And then I give you the recommendation for a 3-to-1 ratio between omega-6 and 3. It could be more omega-3, so you can have a 2-to-1 ratio or a 1-to-1 ratio. You don't want to get lower than a 1-to-1 ratio because too much omega-3 can cause your blood to get too thin. But that sheet is a phenomenal tool that you can use with people. And again, you can take it and you can modify it and you can add your own tweaks to it. And that's something that you'll be able to use with your clients. And it's an awesome spreadsheet. And I also have recipes in the one that I'm going to give you. Those are my recipes. You can plug your own recipes in and figure it out. The way I like to use that spreadsheet is when I create a new recipe is just plug in the fatty pieces in there and I go, oh my God, the omega-6 to 3 ratio is 17. That's not good. How do I shift it? I go, well, if I take out some of the almonds and I put in a few cashews or some coconut instead, or I put some walnuts or hemp seeds or one of the omega-3s and I play with it until I get a really nice ratio. You play around with it, you test the recipe, and it really helps you to create guidelines for your people to be on good. And there's 5 recipes in that spreadsheet that you'll have. Trans fats in the cell membrane. So many people are eating trans fats and some of them don't even know it. Like margarine, mayonnaise, Crisco, those all, and the things that say partially hydrogenated soybean oil. Those are things that are obvious. Chips and crackers and all that kind of stuff has that. what people don't realize is there's also trans fats that get created in the food when you heat them. So if you were to take, say, safflower oil or sunflower oil or corn oil, and you were to saute it, that is going to create trans fats because of the oxidation of those fats and can shift those around. Okay, oxidized fats are as bad as trans fats. People don't realize that. So we'll have it in the guidelines, like what you're going to be sharing with people to avoid. And of course, as you incorporate changes to their diet, you want to go slow. You don't want to just shove it down their throats unless they come in and they go, look, my doctor's going to put me on insulin next week. If I don't, what do I do? Tell them, like, okay, this is serious. I'm going to give you this list and I want you to just do everything on this list. And then they're really motivated at that point. But most people are like, okay, give me one thing at a time, two things at a time. So you'll be feeling out each person you're working with to see what they can handle. Of course, deficiencies of chromium, magnesium, zinc, B vitamins, boron, lithium, basic deficiencies create insulin resistance. And we're going to look at specifically how the chromium and magnesium look. And we're also going to show you some specific foods that help the resistance to get better. Eating high glycemic snacks and meals and sweet drinks, of course, that shoots up the sugar and creates a resistance. And also insufficient protein. And I want to address this one because it's not just insufficient protein in the diet. You may have somebody who's eating plenty of protein, but they're not getting it into their cells. And there's a few markers you can look at on a blood panel. We go through that in a lot of detail in the Client Assessment Tools for Holistic Practitioners, CAT. We call it CAT for short, the CAT program. But in general, BUN, B-U-N, or protein, globulin, albumin, those numbers on your blood test will say, this person might have a low protein. And when you ask them, you find out, I eat bacon and eggs for breakfast and they're eating plenty of protein. Then you're going to suspect malabsorption. And that can be related to stomach acid. And we go through that in depth in how to correct that and all in our year-long coaching program. So insufficient protein, it doesn't matter how much is in the diet, it matters how much is getting in. And that protein will throw off the resistance and it will cause them to become more insulin resistant. So an overview of what your goal is in helping them put a plan in place to reverse this. And number one is get the nutrients in place like we talked about in part one. That's the nutrients that help to restore insulin sensitivity. I'm going to give you guidelines, but I'm going to give you also a whole list of various ones. You may get fortunate with most people and just do the top three and they get results, but there's also times when you need to be adding more the herbs, more of the nutrients that we're going to talk about and will be shared in depth on the site. I'm giving you an overview, but there's a lot more information. I want to give it to you in a lot of different ways, so repetition causes it to sink. Carbohydrate avoidance, we want to keep the sugars below 110. I always have to share with people, I'm not a low carb advocate. I'm a perfect amount of carb advocate. What's the right amount of carb for that person? Like I said, some people can eat 8 bananas and only have their sugars go up to 98. That person doesn't need to start avoiding all their carbs. Whereas someone else eats a half a grapefruit and it goes to 185, they have to be more careful. A lot of things play into it. Their early diet, their genetics, their weight, other health conditions. So we're going to focus on doing a plan with people and putting together a 30-day plan for your person where they're going to keep their sugars below 110. And I'll share with you how we do that. Avoiding allergens. I have a list of the top 6 allergens, and that will be incorporated on the site. I usually look at gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, and peanuts. So those are the 6 top allergens. Does it mean that every client you work with is allergic to one or more of those? No, but I like to put people on a program for about 30 days where they avoid those and see if they can decrease inflammation in the process because that's going to help their insulin resistance. And then we talk about, I'll share with you a way that you help them to reintroduce things. And we go through that, all of those stages in the program, which you'll be going through in October after we get through all of this. Then there's foods that aid in insulin sensitivity. I have charts that you'll have on the website that you can print out, that you can create your own version of. You can add to it if you want, however you want to do it. There's herbs that assist in blood sugar management. And I'm going to go through a little bit of the mechanisms of some of those so that you can kind of get an idea if there's certain ones that may or may not be best for your client. The nutrients that helps keep the blood sugars balanced. There's the basic ones, and then there's others as well. And then finally, the timing of meals for optimum insulin growth and hormone balance. This is the basis of the nutritional pieces that you're going to need. We'll be going over these and over these and over these. I will be providing you with videos and audios and charts and whatever is appropriate to help you to provide the information you need to share this with your clients. Don't start with takeaways. Start with ads. Teach them about making green smoothies if they don't already know that. Teach them about juicing greens if they don't already know that. Teach them about omega-3 fats if they don't already know that, right? You sense where they're at. There's a package of little beverages that you can get them started on that are fun and delicious. So you just get them started on some things. So the documents that you have, shopping guidelines, which people aren't used to shopping this way. They're not used to maybe eating a lot of produce. They're used to going to the fast food and the frozen food aisle. So it's like how to stock a healthy pantry and where can you order things online. So that's a guideline that you have in part one. Hydration, there's a whole thing on how do you get them to drink right, right? Somebody can be dehydrated. This whole process is going to be thrown off. I give you a digestion strategies PDF, greens, like an introduction to greens, what they are, how they work, charts, and some recipes, a beverages document, and then we talk about omega-3 rich foods, chia, hemp, etc. These are things that you have and you're going to use as you put together your handouts to hand people during a program that they're doing with you, whether it's a one-on-one program or you're doing it as a group. I highly recommend that you take some people through this one-on-one before you tackle a group, because the dynamics, you'll learn more the dynamics and what problems people come into. And if you're suddenly never done this before and you've got 6 or 8 people you're guiding through it, it's a challenge. I did this for many years with people one-on-one, many, many years. And then I decided to offer it as a group. And my first group program, I shockingly got about 110 people in. And I was very happy that I had 20 years of experience with this going through that, because a lot of stuff can come up. And we're going to be looking for people who get certified as insulin resistance practitioners and are really good at this. I'm going to have people help me in doing group programs to provide more one-on-one and support for people. So I'm going to be looking for people who really master this and want to do that and are, you know, good practitioners that way. Nutrients. So these are the basic ones. Chromium, magnesium, and DHA, and there's a comprehensive PDF that has all the supplements in chromium, magnesium, DHA, explains them, explains sources, places you can get them, dosages. So I highly recommend you look at that. And let me just talk a little bit about the mechanisms, because I know, you know, you guys are practitioners and people are going to ask you, well, why does that work and how? And if you understand it a little bit more, then you're going to be able to explain it to them. So why is chromium important in blood sugar metabolism, right? Why? Because it is important to escort that insulin molecule attached to the sugar across the cell membrane. It helps the insulin receptors to move it across, right? And this is a picture of the protons and neutrons, and it's just a scientific picture. It's more for making the thing, you know, pretty than anything else. But that's basically, this is a molecule. I mean, it's a chromium. 800 micrograms a day is the recommended dose. I'd like to get people, if they are willing to do it in divided doses, 200 micrograms per meal and then one at bedtime. The one at bedtime helps to maintain the blood sugar levels overnight. That's especially important if somebody is waking up with really high blood sugar. If somebody's waking up in the middle of the night hungry, you probably don't want to give them that chromium at bedtime. Okay, but they usually come in 200 microgram capsules, and so you can do them 2 per meal. Some of them come in formulas where there's 300 per, so you'll get 900, no big deal. So it's, you know, it's all guidelines approximate. Some people need less, and when we get to talking about what do you do after you've had them go through a 30-day program to determine what they can add back in, we'll talk about how to work with the supplements then. Chromium promotes the binding of insulin to the cells, so it's really important. It's stored in the liver in between meals, and it's released whenever the insulin gets secreted. If you take it with the meal, then it just saves your body a little extra work, right? So the liver doesn't have to secrete it. You've actually got it there. Elevated and prolonged insulin curves, okay? That's like I had the other day where my sugar was up at 147 at an hour and a half. that's a long insulin curve. I was really using up a lot of chromium. At the end of that hour and a half, I actually took some chromium in water to help bring it down. So, and it strip mines all the chromium. And I hadn't taken it because I'm not good at taking supplements throughout the day. I had taken my chromium in the morning. And I'm trying to think if I even took my chromium because I'm not very regular in taking it all the time. It's important to get people to be regular with it, especially when they're having these issues. So it's kind of this vicious cycle that you have to stop. Excess insulin promotes the excretion of chromium. Deficiency of chromium then promotes you to produce more insulin. So it's this vicious cycle. So we stop it by giving them the extra chromium. Do they have to stay on 800 micrograms of chromium for the rest of their life? It depends. I mean, if somebody is a type 2 diabetic and you're using this protocol to reverse that and they're getting good, you've got to test. You don't want to just take them off. Okay, you've done it. Stop the chromium. There's a whole process that we'll talk about towards the end of this, is how do you put people back and see what they have to do long term for maintenance. Magnesium, what's its mechanism? Well, again, different amounts. It's 400 to 800 milligrams per day. So it's milligram dose. You need a lot more magnesium than you need chromium, 1,000 times more, right? 400 to 800 milligrams versus micrograms. This is the magnesium molecule. Insulin produces loss of magnesium. It kind of acts like a diuretic, if you know what that is. It makes you pee away the excess magnesium. So when you have too much insulin, as in hyperinsulinemia, you get a lot of magnesium being lost. And then magnesium is essential for the cellular response. So for the cells to pick up the insulin, you have to have enough magnesium. So you've got, again, this situation where when you have too much insulin, which is produced as a result of insulin resistance, because the insulin's not getting into the cells, then you pee away the magnesium. And then that low magnesium that results makes you even more insulin resistant. So breaking the cycle by adding the 400 to 800 milligrams per day. However, they may need more than that. And that's just a guideline. And in the documentation, I've got a chart that's the magnesium loading document. And it teaches you how to teach your clients how to know how much magnesium they really need, how to really tailor that to them. And I'll let you read that, but it has to do with bowel tolerance, similar to when you do that with vitamin C. So it's important for them to be replenishing their nutrients. We talked already about the chromium and magnesium. DHA, which I said was important for the cellular membrane, a deficiency in the cell membrane will decrease insulin sensitivity, 300 to 500 milligrams per day. That's an omega-3 fat. And some people need more. The people that need more tend to have more brain fog, who tend to have problems with ADD, with memory, with mental function, because DHA is important for the neurologic function. So they may need 500, they may need a little bit higher than that. You'll just kind of use that as a starting point. When you get them to eat lots of green leafy vegetables and sea vegetables, you're loading them up on minerals, B vitamins, antioxidants. And in sea vegetables, there is also a little bit of omega-3 fats, especially in the algaes. So how else are they going to replenish through food? Chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds for omega-3s. And a little hint here, I always have people do coconut with their omega-3 fats, because there were a few studies that said that coconut will actually increase the conversion of the short-chain omega-3 fats into DHA and EPA by tenfold. The first research I saw on that was by Gabriel Cousins, and he quoted some studies, so if you want to look that up. There's mysteric acid, which seems to be one of the fatty acids in the coconut that tends to have the most effect on that conversion, but also lauric acid as well, to an extent. Pumpkin seeds are a good source of zinc, important for this. Brazil nuts are a good source of selenium. Protein powder is important for those folks who are showing protein deficiency. And a lot of folks with the insulin resistance are starting the day with a high carb breakfast. They're not getting enough protein. They're eating a standard American diet. They're eating under stress and don't get enough zinc. And that's affecting their stomach acid. The stomach acid affects their absorption of both minerals and protein. So that protein deficiency can be caused by a dietary inadequacy. You know, some people are just kind of trying to make it through the day drinking green juice and nothing else. Or they're just eating donuts and coffee all day long and they have a protein deficiency. because a lot of people are so carbohydrate addicted that that's what they eat all day, or they have the impaired digestion. So it's up to you to learn that. Small quantities of lean, organic, free-range animal protein or fish for people that may want to get that instead of the extra protein powder or in addition to it. And so some people, when they're in the state of really severe insulin resistance, don't do well unless they continue to include, or they do include, a little bit of lean, organic, free-range animal protein. And I've worked with a few people like that who wanted to go raw, they wanted to do vegan, and they couldn't do it. They needed to have it. But they're doing all the same things as somebody who is raw or vegan, but they're including a little bit of fish or free-range meat or buffalo or something with their meals. So this doesn't have to be a vegan or raw foods program, and it doesn't have to include animal protein. And that's what I'm teaching you differs from what you're going to read mostly. If you see a lot of the insulin resistance books or even Mark Hyman's book, there's a lot of animal protein in there. And people who are choosing to be vegetarian and who prefer not to eat quite that much animal protein are having to really massage the recipes, where it's much easier to start with really balanced whole foods, high vegetable recipes, and then say, well, you can add 3 ounces of fish to this, or you can stir fry in 3 ounces of meat with this stir fry. So that's how I prefer to give it. Personally, I'm vegan. I've been vegan for 28 years, and I do really well that way. Some people I work with don't. And some of it may be the genetics, some of it may be cultural, some of it may just be psychological. So, you know, really, if you are vegan or raw and you're tending towards wanting your people to go that way, really understand that they can do really well if they can do most of that stuff and include a little bit of protein. So optimizing the level of nutrients, here's some amounts. There's a whole document, a supplement checklist for improving insulin sensitivity. It's a PDF document that you have. The vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams 3 times a day, is a good starting point, but it's really good to get people on as much as they need. And I've given you a document called Vitamin C Calibration to give you instructions on how to go there. D3 is critical, and I think that they should get their vitamin D's tested and get them in the range of 75 to 100. Now, if they live in Canada, in Montreal, or someplace up there, Winnipeg, they could lay naked on their roof all winter long, and they're not gonna get any vitamin D, because the sun, it's not direct enough. And what happens, actually, it's considered that anything north of Atlanta, Georgia, you don't get enough direct sun in the winter to have reasonable exposure to sunshine, keep it steady. So you either have to have somebody who just loads up on sunshine throughout the summer, maintains a high level, and then they check throughout the winter to make sure. Really recommend that for a year, people get their vitamin D levels tested every 3 months to see how the sun exposure affects it and what kind of supplementation they need to do to maintain it. I supplement people from anywhere from 1,000 IUs to 20,000. Depends on where they're at, okay? We go through that in more detail in other programs like the thyroid program. So vitamin B complex, overall energy and hormone support. So it's really critical for maintaining, looking at their levels. And if they're eating a lot of processed foods, they're gonna need a lot more B complex. If they've been eating a whole foods diet for a long time, they get lots of sea vegetables and greens, they may not need as much. They may be just fine with getting it through food. And then the magnesium loading document I gave you to ensure the adequate magnesium intake is critical. Magnesium is important for over 325 different enzyme systems in the body. You want to get them to trash some foods, okay? Strictly for at least the first 2 weeks and ideally for 30 days. The only way you let them get away with testing some of the more innocuous of these foods after 2 weeks is if they're really improving and they're really begging you and they're willing to test their glucose very rigorously to see. So the things that need to go, high glycemic carbohydrates. That includes a lot of different things. We have a whole separate page on that. Processed fats, trans fats, oxidized fats, heated fats. All of the fats need to be unprocessed whole food fats, with the exception if they want to have a little bit of olive oil in a stir fry or coconut oil in a stir fry, that's okay. But any other fats heated and large amounts of those, just using the heat, the oils freely, oils, when they're processed, are going to have some degradation no matter how careful the processing is. So I prefer the whole food fats, avocado, coconut, nuts and seeds, those sorts of things. Top allergens and all known allergens. So not only the six top allergens, but if they know that they're allergic. You'd be surprised how many people will say, wow, every time I eat eggplant, I get hives and whatever, you know, and I just, I have to lay low or take vitamin C afterwards. You say, how often do you eat eggplant? Oh, you know, just not often, once a week or so. You're like, why do you eat something you know that you're causing an adverse effect in your body for? During this process of resetting their insulin receptivity, it's really important to keep the inflammation down. So get them to look at what foods they know they've been allergic to in the past or have been had a test that said they are or that they've just reacted to. Plus, get them to avoid those top six allergens. Say, look, we're just going to do this for a month and then we're going to let you test. Gluten is critically important to avoid for longer than that because the effects of gluten can cause inflammation for way longer. Gluten affects the brain, it affects the bones, it affects the gut. And if you're not off of gluten and you're even the slightest bit sensitive, their gut's going to be leaky, it's going to be irritated, and they're not going to be getting all this great nutrition you're teaching them about. So you want to look at foods and combinations that raise insulin but not glucose. We talked about those. You can review that. There was a couple of fishes. There's a chart that will show you the insulin index and the glycemic index. And then commercially grown food as much as possible. That's one that it's really hard to be 100% on that, but the commercially grown food, pesticides have been shown to affect insulin receptors. Gabriel Cousins in his book, Reversing Diabetes, talks about that. You want to break the vicious cycle of high glycemic carbohydrate addiction. People don't realize that the addiction is not just them being weak. It has to do with physiology. High glycemic carbs promote excess insulin, and then the normal cells adapt to the high levels by turning off and thus require a very large amount of insulin to open up. They say, nope, I'm not going to do this. And then when you get the levels up high enough, they have issues going on. So high insulin leads to hypoglycemia. Why? Because now they've had to produce a lot of insulin to get anything to open up. Mostly it's the fat cells that open up, so it gets stored as belly fat. But then that leads to the sugar going down rapidly. And then they have hypoglycemia, which leads to cortisol secretion because it's an emergency, or adrenaline spikes. And that starts to reduce their muscle stores and break that down into sugar. And that creates a craving for the high glycemic carbs. So it's a vicious cycle that needs to be broken. And how are you going to do it? You're going to eliminate the high glycemic carbs and processed fats. Some of these are no's. Regardless of whether they want to test their blood sugars or not, I just recommend they stop it. No sugar or any relatives. No coconut nectar, agave, anything that has any glycemic at all. Because some people, coconut nectar, yes, low glycemic sugar raises your sugar up to 160. No, thank you. So I recommend they get off of all of that. Stevia, xylitol, erythritol, Lohan, Lakanta. Those are sugars that are okay. They're no glycemic. And small amounts, because some people have irritation if they have too much of those. I get them off of all flour, crackers, breads, pasta, even no gluten stuff, right? Gluten-free crackers, gluten-free pasta, gluten-free bread, they're usually made with refined flours. Flour raises the insulin levels, the sugar levels and then the insulin levels, way more quickly than a whole grain carbohydrate. But during this reset period, which I like it to be at least 3 weeks, but I normally do a 30-day period, I don't have them do any grains, possibly quinoa, if they really need to do it or they're very active athletically, or if they are very thin and they need the calories. And if they test the glucose and it's normal, I'll review with you what normal means on the next slide. No legumes unless the glucose is tested normal, okay? And it has the normal curve. Legumes may peak a little bit later because they're a little bit slower to be absorbed. But if they shoot the sugar up to 140, it's no good. I talked about how whenever the sugar goes above 120, 140, you get various changes to the retina and the peripheral nerves. So real important stuff. No potatoes because they tend to shoot people's sugars up. Although this isn't across the board. Some people eat potatoes with no problem. But sweet potatoes, yam, and squash tend to not raise the sugar as much. So if they really need that extra carb and they need that fillingness, you can have them test those. And if the glucose testing says it's okay, meaning they follow their curve out from before they eat up to about 3 hours, 4 hours after they eat, and their sugars never go above 110 and never go below where they started, then they can include it. It's not going to be a problem. I keep them off of all the bananas, mangoes, papaya, and other high sugar fruits because they do cause those swings. No dried fruit, no fruit juice. Avoid the heated oils and trans fats, like I said before. And low glycemic only fruits in small quantities, like blueberries. For some people work, for others they don't. For some people, the blueberries will work if they eat it on a salad or with some lettuce, but not blended. That's me. I can't eat it blended because it goes in too quickly. Probably because I drink the smoothie too quickly, but either way, I don't do it that way anymore. But you work with the people and you help them. You look at their charts and you help them through. We'll talk about charting and tracking in a bit. You want to balance their omega-3s and 6s, avoiding the oxidized fats, ideally no oils at all. We've talked about all this before. No margarine, mayonnaise, corn oil, soybean oil, vegetable oils. The only oils in very moderate amounts would be olive or coconut, lightly heated, although not ideal, or a little bit of cold flax oil, especially if they tend to need the extra calories. Most of the people you're going to be working with this problem are not going to be concerned about losing too much weight. They're going to be concerned that they have too much weight. But quite frankly, the ones that are thin and insulin resistant are a little bit harder to deal with because they tend to lose a lot of weight. When I first did the low glycemic thing because of my issue, I had to be really careful to make sure that I didn't lose too much weight. And in fact, I did. I dropped down to about 106 pounds when I first started doing it. And then I figured out my way of what I needed to be eating to keep it up without the carbs. So I've been doing this low carbohydrate thing for about 2 years. I keep testing my sugars because I'm so busy and I don't often do the sleep part that I know I should. I haven't responded as quickly as other people have. If you get them to do all the pieces, they generally respond at least majorly changed within 30 days. Will they then be able to go back and eat, you know, ice cream again without having a sugar problem? No, right? You want them to stay away from that stuff. But you give them the tool, the glucose meter is their tool to be able to see how they can not restrict their diet versus restrict it. Somebody wanted to not do it, and I knew she was having some issues, and I said, look, you can either do the 30 days on the strictest protocol of all and see how it goes, or you can get the glucose meter and test some things and see if blueberries are okay, see if lentils are okay for you. And she finally agreed to get the glucose meter after not wanting to do it for a while. So it's cool when you can get people to do that. But if they're so resistant and so needle phobic, then you just put them on the strictest program and then they learn to see how they feel then. And you have to work with them a little bit more closely when they start to introduce foods because it's not this objective thing, like the sugar goes up. It's more like they subtly don't feel as good or they have, you know, a crash, or so you're watching them more carefully. The more you do this, the easier it becomes and the more natural it becomes. I have a whole book of glucose balancing beverages, something I call the AM Gut Rejuvenator, which I took from a digestive balancing course I did a couple of years ago. It helps people get steady in the morning. People always say it feels so good, so I incorporate that. Blended green drinks, also called green smoothies or green soups, green drinks, energy drinks, flavored water, where it's just essential oils in the water. And there are certain essential oils like cinnamon and orange and lemon and grapefruit and caraway and dill that actually help with the blood sugar balance. Caraway and dill are not so great on their own, but they're good in foods. And then protein shakes. So all of these things are explained in the beverages document. And also the other document that you guys have is my blood glucose 30-day program. It's a 30-day menu plan, and you can adapt that to the people you're working with. You can create your own from it. There's recipes in there they can follow, you can follow. It's just an awesome guide. And you can create recipes based on those too. You can create your own recipes. That's what most people end up doing. These are some resources that are on part two page. I already talked about the omega 3 and 6 content of common foods. There's a PDF version of it, which is just printed out. You have to do the calculations yourself. But there's an Excel version for those of you who are spreadsheet savvy that you can put the numbers in and it calculates for you. There's a chia seed nutrition chart. There's a foods that improves insulin sensitivity chart, foods effect on glucose and insulin chart, how the glycemic index of foods are measured resource. There's herbalist, there's a supplement list, the magnesium loading, vitamin C calibration, food sources of potassium page. And the reason we put that in is because people started to develop slight potassium deficiencies when they first started doing this and getting leg cramps. So that's something to watch for. If they start to get leg cramps when you put them on the magnesium and take them off the high glycemic foods, because a lot of the high glycemic foods are good sources of potassium. So we have a food sources there like broccoli and avocado and other things. And then finally, I've given you the dirty dozen and clean 15 lists so that you can help them to reduce their pesticide consumption. And this is a copy of it. And this is just downloaded from the FDA site. Gabriel Cousin says, "And there is a cure for diabetes. Pesticides may damage insulin receptors." It's an awesome book. It's big and thick, and I'm giving you, you know, all the general stuff. He gives you a lot of the background stuff. So if you want to learn more, he doesn't go quite into some of the pathways and the metabolic pathways as much as I do because it's written for lay people, but it's a good book, and they've got some good recipes in there as well. There's a new version of it too. So here's some of the foods that improve insulin resistance on the site. There'll be a list with the description of these and some of the mechanisms behind it. Broccoli, avocado, alfalfa, blueberries for some people. See, blueberries have a chemical that improve insulin resistance, but the sugar in it may increase the sugar and people in early stages can't go with it. So you have to see. Greens, Brussels sprouts, citrus peel extract. So even if you just like use the little kind of microplaner to take the skin off, you can blend the citrus peel or get extracts like the lemon oil or whatever. Turmeric, stevia actually can help improve insulin resistance. Bitter melon, prickly pear, nopal cactus is awesome at it. There's actually a supplement that Health Force Nutritionals makes. They used to just call it nopal cactus, and now they call it blood sugar balancer. And it's got the nopal cactus in it. So those are good things. And these are the things that you can encourage people to start to use and use more freely. And cinnamon, for people who have resistance, it's just slow to go down. You can get them to do a tablespoon a day of cinnamon as a tea mixed in with a pudding, put on top of their chia porridge. Really helpful. Cardamom, ginger, algae, and seaweed. I didn't put cacao because there's some mixed feelings about it. So here's some others. Jerusalem artichoke, it has inulin, and that helps to maintain the blood glucose levels. Cabbage has a chemical called beta oleracea, and that's an antioxidant that helps to increase insulin sensitivity. Cucumber has a substance that's needed by the beta cells to produce insulin. And Gabriel Cousins writes a lot about that in his book. Garlic and onion contain sulfur, which helps. And then carob contains a substance called pinetol, which helps. Cacao is mixed. Some people say it's not worth it because it's too stimulating. Some people do really well with it, and it can help bring it down. Some of these foods are more effective than others. I know people who will eat something, their blood sugar goes up too high, they'll eat a half an avocado, and it drops it back down. Same with chia. So just help your people with this and working with these foods and really teach them how to do the glucose monitoring because that's going to really help them through it. Herbs are your friends in this regard. People can incorporate these freely. They can take them as supplements or they can take them as food. Fenugreek lowers insulin and triglycerides and increases HDL. So it's good for insulin resistance, and it's especially good for people who've gone beyond the just plain insulin resistance into metabolic syndrome. Cinnamon enhances insulin receptor sensitivity. Maitake improves sensitivity and lowers sugar, insulin, and triglycerides. So again, it's good for the people who've gone beyond because it's affecting the triglycerides. So maitake, it's an awesome mushroom. You can get it as a powdered extract or as a powder. You can make mushroom broths and things with it. You can also sometimes get it fresh. We have a store here locally that sometimes has fresh maitake. And you can also get the whole ones dried, and then you can soak them and make them into soups and put them into stir fries and things like that. Bitter melon lowers both your insulin and triglycerides, so that's cool. Basil improves insulin sensitivity. Nopal, they don't really understand the mechanism other than it does slow the absorption of sugar through the intestinal wall. And ginger decreases inflammation, which is really cool, and it increases sensitivity. a few more, and these are controversial. I pulled these out and put them on separate slides, gymnema and ginseng. So gymnema silvestri is touted as an excellent herb for lowering blood sugar. And indeed it does lower blood sugar. It slows the absorption of glucose. The problem is it may increase insulin production. However, it's possible that its insulin resistance improving capabilities override that, but you just have to be careful with people who have insulin resistance. Good for people with type 1 diabetes because it'll help lower the glucose and increase the insulin, which is what you want. Or in those folks who've progressed to type 2 diabetes, a later stage where they tend to be not producing at all and the docs want to put them on insulin. So keep this in mind. Just be careful using it with people with the earlier insulin resistance and the hyperinsulinemia stages. Ginseng, again, decreases the blood sugar and doesn't have effect on serum lipids, so it's not as good as some of the others in that regard. But it's theorized that it reduces the glucose by slowing the intestinal absorption of the glucose. Not really sure. Again, it might raise insulin. It's unclear if it does as much as the gymnema or if it does at all, but there's some studies that indicate that it might. So again, be careful of people who have advanced insulin resistance and are hyperinsulinemia, anemic. But it's also so good for the adrenals, and it's an adaptogen, so it can indirectly improve insulin resistance by overall decreasing cortisol levels and keeping everything steady. So these are the ones that just use cautiously, learn about them, study them, and just, you know, watch out who you use them for. So as you're putting somebody on a program, you want to give them foods that they can eat in unlimited quantities. Like, hey, eat as much as you want of these foods. Vegetables, raw or cooked, unlimited, except the high carbohydrate vegetables. Be careful with things like carrots and beets and squash and sweet potatoes. I find that personally, if I grate raw carrots, I'm fine. But if I cook the carrots, at least the last time I tried, I haven't tried it in probably a year. But when I was first testing, I found that cooked carrots would raise my blood sugar. So just have people watch that. But unlimited quantities of their greens and broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage and all those things, the low carbohydrate vegetables. They can do the blueberries, apple, grapefruit, which are low glycemic fruits, if they can keep their blood sugar maintained below 110. Raw nuts, especially soaked and rinsed, is best because it pre-germinates them and helps them to be better absorbed. Coconut tends to be great for everybody, but let me say that coconut water from a fresh Thai coconut, that can cause the sugar to go up. Again, I'm speaking from my personal experience, but also working with lots and lots of people through this. I've worked with hundreds of people through this process. I find that if I just drink the water from a coconut, even if I eat the coconut meat with it, my sugar goes up. But if I take the coconut water and I do a culturing to it, or I drink it as kefir, then that's fine. It doesn't raise my sugar at all. So that's just my personal experience. Other people have experienced that, but a lot of people get their sugars raised on coconut water, but coconut in general doesn't tend to do that. Again, we're testing, right? Raw seeds. Pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, omega-3 rich ones like chia, hemp, flax, those are all good. Caraway seeds, those other kinds of seeds are good too, cardamom seeds. Daily omega-3, of course, your chia, flax, hemp. Algae is another good source of it. Purslane, which is a wild green, can't get it everywhere, but you can go buy purslane seeds and throw them in your garden. They're considered weeds, so they'll probably grow. So you can encourage people to grow purslane. It's got a little, like a citrusy taste. It's very yummy. Cold water fish and wild game, or organic free-range meat, if they're not a vegetarian, they don't have allergies to it, they don't have an aversion to it, some people need that. They can eat that. I wouldn't say unlimited quantities for that because it's heavy. Same thing with the nuts and seeds. It's not unlimited quantities. It's, you know, within reason, enough to keep them full. Foods that they should test and then eat cautiously, even if they test okay. And when I say test, I mean testing it out for 5 or 6 hours. I describe the glucose tolerance test on the glucose page. And they never get the glucose to exceed 110, but it never also dips below their starting value. So these are the things that they need to be careful about. if they test these foods and they find that this applies, they don't go above 110 and they don't dip below, I still wouldn't do them in large quantities because it may be the quantity that will cause it to do that. And we're really trying to reset these insulin receptors. Low sugar, high water content fruits. I wouldn't go more than one serving a day during the 30 days that you're working with the metabolic reset. Legumes, some people tolerate them, some people don't. Some people need them to keep the sugar steady or to keep their weight on, or they're athletic and they just need extra volume and they don't want to eat too much, can't eat too much in the way of fruit. Starchy seeds like quinoa and buckwheat, best to avoid for at least the first 2 weeks just to not take chance and then do the testing on it. I find that most people are okay with quinoa, especially if they sprout it. Buckwheat is interesting. Sprouted buckwheat seems to be fine. My husband tried cooked buckwheat and it shot his sugar up to 160, but he's had some buckwheat crackers and it didn't seem to do that. So have them differentiate between the sprouted versus the cooked, and that can make a difference too. Same with quinoa. Those are actually considered seeds, but they're starchy seeds versus the fattier seeds like flax and sesame and hemp and all those. Meal planning. You've got all of this in the menu planner, which you have access to. That's a page that's put together for people who join the program or who don't join the program and they just buy that option. Go through that. Start to experiment with recipes. Modify them to your tastes and the tastes of your patients. The Gut Rejuvenator, I like people to have. Green protein drink. They don't have to have all of this, but these are options. And they'll have as much of this as they need to feel satiated, not overstuffed and overfull, and able to make it to the next meal. At least 3 hours, if not 5 hours, ideally. And we'll talk a lot more about timing later on. Chia drink, there's recipes for that. Green smoothie. With or without fruit, if they test okay for the low glycemic fruit, that's okay. There's a bunch of recipes that are green smoothies without fruit. That's what I've gotten used to. We have these wonderful green smoothies, have a little avocado to make, give them that creaminess because they don't have the fruit, keeps them from separating, and we put all kinds of great seasonings and things in there. Plenty of recipes for you to choose from, experiment with. You may have your own recipe guides that you can share with. And you may have your own recipes that are higher glycemic that you can modify based on the guidelines in the program to help people and share with people. It's great to give people handouts. And you want to give credence to you as an authority, so create your own little handouts and your own little ebooks. Breakfast entrees. I have a whole bunch of breakfast entrees in there, like, you know, a quiche and a non-egg quiche type of thing. Greens and chia and coconut are an important thing to start the day with because it helps to keep everything steady. Talked to someone today on one of my coaching calls for my energy recharge group, and she said, oh my God, my sugar cravings are gone ever since I started doing the greens and the chia and the coconut in the morning. And it's so nice to not have the sugar cravings. What we're going to find out is that it's important that they don't start their day with carbohydrates. And I have that on the summary document. So for meal planning for lunch and dinner, I'm giving you the same options because they can eat the same sorts of stuff. Blended soups, vegetable-rich soups, raw or cooked. Y'all, a lot of people like to do all raw. Some people have gut problems and they can't do all raw. Some people just really are used to and want that heating, or they tend to have a cold constitution according to Chinese medicine and they need that warmth. A healthy fat helps those to be tastier but also help keep the sugar steady longer. Salad with a dressing. You know, you guys know how to do that, right? Teach people how to do that. A vegetable dish, raw, cooked, or both, right? You can have a chopped up kale salad. You can have sauteed broccoli, steamed broccoli. Make it rich and full. There's all kinds of wonderful sauces in the recipe guide. You can make up your own. I'm sure you have some of your own recipes that you share with people. Just create it in such a way that they feel satiated and they're following the guidelines. A protein source. It's really important to have a protein source because remember we said protein's important. So it could be a vegan source. It could be they eat raw vegan veggie nut pate or dehydrated cracker or a veggie burger or cooked veggie burger, nuts or seeds in salad or salad dressing. That would provide some protein. Or if they're not vegetarian and they really feel comfortable with the animal stuff, they can put 3 ounces of the lean organic meat with the meal. We're trying not to be dogmatic with people. And you may find that one thing works really well for you and you want to just pass that on. And I did that for a while. It's like, raw vegan, this is what works. And I found that it doesn't work for everybody. And I had to be really careful about modifying it for specific people. And now some people will say, well, not on all raw. And, you know, because every time I eat salad, I get a gut problem. I work on working on their leaky gut and get them off of raw food for a while. So some people say that the cooked vegetables make their blood sugars go up. So be careful about that. Like if they eat too much cooked and not enough raw. And you can also blend and combine. And that's one way to do it. Really, for desserts, when people have that desire for sweets after a meal, it may not go away right away. That's when it's really important to get the chromium and magnesium in them, okay? And it'll take a while, so why not help them satisfy their dessert feeling with the low glycemic desserts? If you look at those recipes, you'll be able to take your own recipes or theirs and help them to turn them into low glycemic versions. And it just helps to take the edge off. They can make up a batch and keep it in the freezer to curb their cravings. Using omega-3 rich things in them, like you can put some hemp seeds in them. You can change the recipes, add a little hemp or chia if they're not getting it elsewhere. There's so many ways. There's just so many ways. It's endless. And just play with it, okay? There's a lot here. The snack attack strategy, I really advise that they go longer between meals. They're not going to do that right away because they're not used to it, right? So what you teach them is if they've got an urge for a snack and it's only been 3 hours since their last meal or less, tune into the sensation. Sometimes it's emotional. Sometimes they're reaching for the food because it's emotional, and you can coach them on how to handle that. You can teach them tapping. You can teach them alternatives. You want them to differentiate hunger from thirst. So what I have them do typically is have them drink about 16 ounces of water or up to 32, and then wait 30 minutes. And if they're still hungry, then it's probably hunger, and they can go ahead and eat something. And then I have a list of blood sugar friendly foods, and what you'll have on your site is a snack attack strategy document. So here's some of the foods in order from the most innocuous to the least. So the ones that are least likely to raise their blood sugar. I give you a recipe for something called green water, which is a handful of greens with a whole lot of water. It just gives them some minerals. They could do green juice, not fruit, but except lemon and lime. They can do water with a tablespoon of green powder, flavored to taste awesome, like mint or lemon or lemongrass or whatever they like. Water with a tablespoon of green powder and a serving of protein powder. Because a lot of times this craving for food is nutrients that they need, not calories. And when you give them these green, nutrient-dense foods, they're good to go. Maybe they need a little bit of omega fat, so get them to try one of the energy drinks, the chia energy drinks. They have greens and protein powder in that as well. They can do vegetable sticks and do that with a raw dip. They can do an ounce of raw nuts and seeds. Or they could do some raw crackers or bread, like a dehydrated flax chia buckwheat cracker, something like that, from the vegetables, nuts, and seeds. So we're looking for nutrient density here, and that's going to help to solve their cravings. And little by little, they will be able to go longer. I have people who just do the spacing between meals initially, and they have tremendous results. Some people have a problem with it, and some people don't. But don't like make them think they have to go 6 hours between meals, like right from the get-go. Work with them to increase that gradually. So as far as the timing of meals, there's no snacking. If they're going to do the snack, they go through the snack attack strategy. It's usually like a mini meal in between, not like sitting at the desk and munching on vegetables all day long. Even that just keeps everything going, keeps the insulin being secreted, and affects the whole balance. Don't let them get famished either. I remember when I first did my first program and people were trying to follow it to the letter, and it's like they're trying to go 6 hours on the first day and they were getting weak and jittery and irritable and having palpitations. No, they've got to phase into that, gradually increase it. So if they typically have to eat every 2 hours, you help them to get to 2.5 hours. Once they're there, you help them to get to 3. You know, as their coach, and if you're working one-on-one with people, you're going to really be able to help them. And I highly recommend, and we talk about the programs, I'll go into more detail, that when you're doing a one-on-one program with people, that you include and incorporate email coaching or quick telephone call coaching, preferably email coaching, where they could say, hey, this is happening, and you can email them back. But you've got to, when you're pricing it, include that amount of time that you're using with them, because it really helps. because if they have to wait a week or two before they can talk to you again and they're having problems in between. But when you're creating the program, you want to make sure that you're compensated for that time. And you may not charge as much at the beginning when you're first practicing this, but once you get good at this, you're going to be in high demand because people are going to get results. Don't let them eat at night. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about the cycles of the hormones. But insulin goes up and growth hormone goes down, leptin goes down. And what they get is they lose the ability to burn fat at night and to detox at night. No carbohydrate breakfast, no high carbohydrate breakfast. The chia seeds, the greens. But if they start their day with like orange juice and toast, they're going to have food cravings later. It creates a whole spike in leptin prematurely, causes the food cravings. I'll share with you all the mechanisms behind that. Eat protein within an hour of waking up. Not everybody has to do this. Some people do better when they skip the morning meal and just do lunch. They do intermittent fasting, but you're going to have to feel them out and see. If there's somebody who says, oh, I just feel so much better if I don't eat in the morning. Still, have them eat something. If they can just do a little bit of green juice, that'll give them some protein, or a handful of chia seeds or hemp seeds or something, or one of the chia beverages or something. But if they do feel better when they go longer, then you can spread it out. And then gradually increase the meal spacing. We'll talk more about that. Tracking is critical. Use the charts I've given you. Create your own. Everybody's different. You're going to like mine a little bit, maybe. You can use it. If not, make your own up. Just use it as a guideline. You want to keep track of what they're eating, how much they're eating, the preparation, at least initially when you're working with them, at least that first week or two. Test their glucose before and after meals according to the charts I've laid out. Checking their pulse before and after meals can help give you an indication if they have allergy-type problems. Their degree of hunger when they go to eat. Are they like emaciated, starving 10? Or are they just like, yeah, I'm a little hungry, a 1? Check that out. Have them assess that and help them to really wait until they're feeling really strong hunger, but not about to keel over hunger. Stress level and emotional state before they eat, because when you start to see levels of glucose go up, they may not make the connection, but you will as an objective second party looking at their stuff. How is their digestion? How many bowel movements are they having? When are they having them? Aches and pains and anything else that they're experiencing and they're coming to you like, I really hate this particular symptom. Have them track it with regard to what they're eating. And you can become the detective, the investigator, the sleuth that's able to help them to determine what's causing the problems. So we've covered a lot, and it all comes back to this thing. We're trying to balance this insulin-glucagon dance so that when they eat, their sugar goes up, the insulin gets in, gets it into their cells, it comes back to normal, they get energized a few hours, 6 hours, 5 hours, 4 hours later, they get hungry again. In between, glucagon comes out and keeps their blood sugar steady. They don't have those drops, even if they have to go 8 hours, 10 hours between meals. And that's it. We're going to be going through this over and over. I've provided you a lot of resources. This is a lot of information. Some of it wasn't new. It was just repetitive. And I'm going to do a lot of repetition and then introduce new stuff.